Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow, to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at Deloitte.com/US/engineering advantage.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey everybody, it's Andy from the Vergecast. On this week's interview episode, Verge policy reporter McKenna Kelly joins me to talk about everything that's happening in tech policy as we go into the 2020 election. This episode's coming out on Super Tuesday. It's a big day in the Democratic primary. What better day to launch the Verge's election coverage for the year, which we did on the website. McKenna and I go through all of the big policy areas that we're covering, from political advertising on social networks. Mike Bloomberg is kind of breaking the whole system and revealing the fault lines. We talk about what is going on with Section 230, and then really what I think is one of the main things, McKenna's favorite, my favorite, broadband access in rural areas, which is a huge issue that is going undercovered. All stuff we're going to cover a lot this year. Check it out. It's McKenna Kelly on the Vergecast. McKenna Kelly, policy reporter at The Verge. Welcome.
Hey, good to be back.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's just kind of like a lot all of the time.
It is a lot all of the time. So this episode is going to come out on Tuesday, which is Super Tuesday.
Super.
We're launching a lot of our election and policy coverage that same day. And I want to talk to you about the big issues that are already in the election, both in sort of the Democratic primary and then obviously what we're going to see in the general election and what we're going to track. And so right now, it seems like you are spending a lot of time asking big platforms what memes are allowed, because Bloomberg is spending an enormous amount of money and he's like pushing the boundaries of political advertising on the platforms. How's that going?
Right. So it's split the platforms in how they enforce it, firstly. But I think it's good to start off on like how this happened. So Bloomberg is a billionaire.
Mike Bloomberg.
He likes to go by Mike and not Michael this time.
Okay.
But Mike Bloomberg is a billionaire. He has billions of dollars, about $60 billion net worth. And he is injecting basically all of that money into social platforms and cable television ads.
Mike Bloomberg started as a middle-class kid who had to work his way through college. Mike Bloomberg knows the value of quality health care.
If we get it done, Mike would get it done.
It's a pretty simple strategy when you have a lot of money.
Yeah.
So Bloomberg bought millions of ads. He buys millions of dollars of ads on Facebook and Google every day. But it's only so much money that you can throw into ads, right? So he's trying to find new ways to get his name out there. So the New York Times reported that the Michael Bloomberg campaign was working with Fuck Jerry, the Fyre Festival people. It was basically sponsoring posts on popular meme pages. So once that was discovered, it basically started this whole new conversation about political advertising, because social media has been filled with branded content for so long.
Yeah, so I just want to unpack everything you said.
Right, yeah. It's a lot.
It's a lot. So first, there is the difference between buying an ad on Facebook and then getting some popular meme account to post something on your behalf.
Right.
And sponsored content, that's what we – branded content is like – it's just a big business on platforms.
Right. Every weight loss shake on Instagram is a branded content post.
Yeah. So influencers post hashtag ad. It's a big business for media companies. So BuzzFeed runs Tasty. It's a big foods like vertical. They post a lot of food videos everywhere. Heinz can be like – the best ketchup recipes, and they're like, buy it. And it's not an ad that you bought from Facebook. It's an ad that you bought from a media company that then organically travels. So Bloomberg is doing both.
Right. Simultaneously.
Okay. I just don't think most people understand that, like, branded content ecosystem is huge.
Right.
And there are entire companies, like, they've actually rebranded. They're Jerry Media now. They're family friendly.
Oh, wow.
But I still think of them as Fuck Jerry. But, like, there are companies that are big, like Jerry Media, that do nothing but branded influencer marketing of this kind. That's just the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
So then Bloomberg is like hacking democracy with his money with both ways, right?
Right. So Facebook didn't have any rules about this because Facebook was operating like any other social platform. The money from branded content does not go to Facebook. I mean, you're talking about all these companies that take the money and it goes to influencers. So Facebook didn't really have to have new rules for political content because this wasn't really done before, or at least that we know of. Mike Bloomberg's campaign was pretty excited about this and was very happy to talk about
it. Yeah, they invented something.
Right. They're like, look at us. So them being so vocal about this forced Facebook to kind of reckon with it.
The influencer marketing.
Side. Right.
And it's not like influencers have not had political stances before.
Right. I mean, one of the influencers who I think of when it comes to like voice, they've endorsed candidates before. I mean, Joe Rogan just endorsed Bernie Sanders. Casey Neistat put out his video in support of Hillary Clinton. And that a couple of years ago got a lot of lashback. So it's not like influencers have been apolitical.
Right. It's the idea that political advertising has come to the influencer marketing economy.
Right, exactly. So Facebook decided, hey, yeah, we're going to allow this as long as influencers use their branded content tool, just like they would for weight loss shakes or things like that, and make sure that users know that it's an ad. So hashtag ad, hashtag sponsored by Mike Bloomberg. So they're letting it happen, which is really interesting and new.
But they don't have to make sure it's true. That's like, this is the heart of the debate. Right.
I mean, so that's the same thing with Facebook's political ads rules in the first place. Facebook doesn't care what a politician says is true or not. That's just the way it's been since they had these rules.
Yeah. And there's a controversy on the you're just buying regular Facebook ad side,
mm-hmm.
are fact-checking political advertising. And I think Elizabeth Warren has like made a lot of hay about this. Like, mm-hmm. you should have to. Facebook says, no, we shouldn't have to. Like, people can figure it out for themselves. And now that same policy is extended to influencer marketing.
Right.
Which seems a little bit more problematic to me. But I think Facebook's position is like, it's all just advertising.
Exactly. Right. These influencer posts could be fact checked, but only if, and this is where the enforcement gets really fuzzy, is if Facebook determines that the ad is in the influencer's voice and not the voice of the candidate. So the policy is unenforceable.
Yeah.
Like I like to say with a lot of policies, it is tremendously difficult to enforce a lot of these.
Yeah.
So it's like, are they meaningful at all? I mean, it raises these questions.
And so then you might as well not have a policy.
Right.
Which is like, I think Facebook often comes up with policies that are so unenforceable that they fundamentally don't have
Facebook,
a policy.
Facebook, every social media platform, I mean.
Well, so but Twitter is taking like a different approach, right?
Right. So, I mean, we have to like kind of go back and look at this video that Mike Bloomberg posted on Twitter.
I'm the only one here that I think that's ever started a business. Is that fair? Okay.
It was after the Nevada debate, right?
Right, yes. So it was directly after, and Bloomberg, like I like to say that he is starting to create content in the same way that the Trump campaign has. So his video, if you're familiar with Carpe Donctum, but he is the Trump memer who...
You're so in it, McKenna. You're like, if you're familiar with this...
If you're familiar with the famous memer, Carpe Donctum, but he's making content very similar to how Trump has in the past.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's really important to note. But the video itself is cut in a way that some people could say is deceptive, but it is a meme video and it is a joke and it's satire.
Right. So this is a video where Bloomberg says, have any of you started a business before? And there's mm-hmm. like literally he's added the sound of crickets.
Right.
I like to imagine that Bloomberg himself opened iMovie and like downloaded like crickets.mp3.
Well, that's the thing. Our videos are so easy to make. And we talk about deep fakes all the time. But those videos, I mean, the Nancy Pelosi video that we talked about last year.
Yeah, where they slowed her down.
She slowed down and it sounds like she's slurring.
We had a little took a little longer on the floor. The custody of the border. Everyone
that wasn't AI.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that was iMovie or that was Premiere Pro or like something. Same thing with the Joe Biden video from a couple weeks ago where people were mad that it was cut in a way to make him sound racist, like he was making white nationalist remarks, but he was actually playing the role of a racist and then it was like cut out. So the platforms have created their own policies to kind of tackle deepfakes, but it leaves all this room for this very easily accessible and media that people create to kind of just skate away. So Twitter has a policy that comes out in March. And basically, they're giving themselves a lot of room, like any platform does, to determine if something should be taken down or if it's a deep fake or what constitutes the type of media. But Twitter told me that this Bloomberg video would receive a new label. So the label would basically just have something on the post saying that this is manipulated media, Which it is. It is manipulated.
Yeah.
And Facebook, I reached out to Facebook. They have a deepfakes policy too, but they also leave themselves a lot of room for satire and parody videos. Facebook said it wouldn't take it down and it wouldn't label it as misinformation either. So they're kind of split on the video part of this.
Yeah. Well, so that Twitter label to me, like everything is edited. Everything is manipulated media. Like no candidate is putting out ads that are just like 24-hour live streams of them shaking hands or giving speeches. Like what's the line there?
So the line here with Facebook and with Twitter, it seems like it's not just they'll label manipulated media, but when it comes to taking things down, it has to be very deceptive or threaten serious harm to candidates or other people. So I don't know if we want to branch out of politics right now. I'm thinking of the only like thing that's like really dangerous, but like misinformation around the coronavirus, for example, and things like that. So if there's a manipulated media post there saying coronavirus is cool, catch it, they would probably take that down, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of where it stands. It's like there is some stuff that can really disrupt the political conversation that we're having. Like the Bloomberg thing kind of stopped some of, you know, our colleagues to really discuss whether or not this should be taken down or whether it's manipulated media and should receive a label. But it really comes down to whether or not it can cause groups of people, communities harm.
I'm just thinking about, I don't know, reality shows.
Mm-hmm.
Like reality shows are famous for editing a narrative into a show that maybe wasn't there.
Right.
And it feels like that Bloomberg ad in particular, like a Top Chef clip highlight supercut of a season is the same exact thing.
Right.
Right. Does that fall under the rules? Like how are you – is it just political ads that fall under these rules? Is it all of that kind of stuff that exists? Is it when we make funny jokes about Samsung events, does that fall into – like that – gets wider and wider and wider over time. And it feels like those kinds of videos in particular, where it's like a joke in a video, have been with us for so long. I don't know if people are that confused.
Right. I mean, with politics now, and even with the 2016 election, lawmakers have been pushing for rules from Facebook and Twitter on this stuff. And I don't know if it's just because it's mostly coming from Democrats because of Trump and their disdain for Trump and how he uses social media. But it is interesting because meme videos and these kind of jokes and recut kind of clips and stuff is such an integral part of the internet and the entertainment ecosystem now. Look back, Stephen Colbert. Like, go back to television. They do this all the time on television,
the,
too.
The Daily Show. Like, the Jon Stewart Daily Show in particular was, like, famous for this, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, it's hard. But after 2016, I think there's this heightened sense amongst lawmakers and amongst politicians that a lot of this can get out of hand. So if you have the Nancy Pelosi video or something like that, maybe your average person wouldn't be deceived, but you could have bots that are blasting this video all across social media and all this. And it just causes problems. It may be some problems that we haven't even really realized are problems yet.
So Twitter did take down some bots that seem to be affiliated with the Bloomberg campaign.
Right. So Twitter, the Los Angeles Times reported a couple days ago that through this like Outvote app that the Bloomberg campaign uses, there was a lot of, they called it spam. They were basically acting as spam accounts, spamming positive remarks from Barbara Streisand about Mike Bloomberg.
That's like the most Bloomberg. It's like I'm a billionaire. What am I spending it on? Fake Barbara Streisand quotes.
Yeah, just to target the boomers. They'll love it. it's really interesting. So they removed about 70 of them. And it's really interesting, too, because when it comes to the Bloomberg stuff, on Facebook doesn't consider that these influencer posts or things coming from the Bloomberg campaign as coordinated and authentic behavior. And it seems like and when we talk about that, we think about Russians, Iranian foreign interference campaigns when we think about inauthentic behavior. But it seems like Twitter is like, no, this is inauthentic behavior, too. So they took down those 70 accounts. And I'm sure there are a lot of these that are still out there.
Yeah, it just seems like a missed business opportunity. Like, I'm like, I should start a network of Twitter accounts and let people buy it.
Right, I should just...
I'm American, for God's sake.
I should make a network of accounts that are just like, McKenna's the best.
Yeah, like, what am I doing? McKenna, that'll be $50?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
McKenna's the best.
Well, it just seems like an obvious sort of, like, business opportunity. Like, there's an entire ecosystem of influencers and bots and, like, social reach companies that will do this stuff for you.
Right.
And if you're Bloomberg and you're just, like, fire-hosing money into the ecosystem... It seems obvious that that will happen.
Right. I mean, people hate it when influencers buy followers or, like, buy posts. But, I mean, it's not something that's, like, new. Like, right. People are like, yeah, this is just part of the internet. But now once we get politics involved with it, it, like, explodes into this mess of, like, anger and outrage over a system that's existed for years now.
Yeah. And so it seems like we keep talking about Twitter and Facebook. They're finding different lines. They're making different rules. They're taking different approaches. That's because there's no overall law or regulation that they have as a guide. They're just making it up as they go.
Right. I mean, imagine asking lawmakers right now to regulate memes. It's hilarious.
I mean, I'm imagining it. I would like to see it happen.
Right.
Like, just to see what that conversation would be like. Just to see them explain memes to each other
mm-hmm.
on the floor of the United States Congress. Mm-hmm. It'd be great. Yeah, that doesn't seem appropriate.
No, at least not in the next 10 years.
Yeah, until, like, we become the members of Congress.
Right, exactly.
That's my goal, is to run on a meme-only platform. It's going to be great. So there's no overall regulation. So they're doing stuff on their own.
Right.
Does one of them seem to be getting it more right than the other, Twitter and Facebook?
Twitter? Okay, this is really interesting. So Facebook comes out. It makes, like, its deepfakes policy. Comes out with it earlier this year, and they get, like, a ton of criticism for it. Twitter announces its own, and it's, like, more of a good guy stance on, like, the deepfakes policy. It's really interesting. It seems like Twitter – now, I don't know. I don't know what my opinion is, but it seems like Twitter is positioning itself as, like, the good guy platform for the election right now. They banned political ads entirely last year. It seems like they're really thinking about how to moderate the platform for political ads and campaigns and posts and stuff into the future. Facebook is still in its, like, very much, like, hands-off approach.
Yeah.
Which still you can trace back to Mark Zuckerberg's speeches over the past couple of years about free speech. And last thing we want to regulate on our platform is speech.
Yeah. I guess, like, both companies have said the political advertising is an inconsequential amount of money mm-hmm. for the bigger businesses, which is in many ways, like, depressing.
Right.
Right, like, Bloomberg can spend all of his money and it's still, like, a drop in the bucket compared to all the advertising on Facebook. Although we should ask them again, because I wonder if the Bloomberg money has, like, changed the balance for them. But they've mostly said this isn't a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter's like, it's not a lot of money. It's too much, like, heartache. We're mm-hmm. just going to turn it off. Like, we don't need the money. Facebook's like, we don't need the money, but we don't want to be involved in that way. We're going to let it happen. Here are some rules. But there's no overall guideline, it's like we're watching this experiment play out.
Right.
And it's very unclear to me which one is better.
Mm-hmm.
And that also sits right next to the candidates themselves, members of Congress right now, calling for moderation regulation for the platforms, calling for changes to 230 mm-hmm. or whatever. Do you see that interaction happening, or is it just chaos?
Well, yeah, no, this week. It was really interesting. David Cicilline, who was on The Vergecast, he talked about – it hasn't been introduced yet, but he's talking about a bill that would amend Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act in a way that platforms wouldn't receive those really important protections unless they ensured that their platforms weren't running false political ads. So you're seeing these things engage in a really interesting way that we haven't seen before. But – was definitely going to come.
Yeah. Well, 230 is, I mean, that's the next sort of big thing to talk about. There's the campaign and sort of like meme doctrine. I don't know what you would call it. The meme wars that are occurring.
I can't wait to write that. That's my next piece.
Meme doctrine.
The meme doctrine.
It's real. I mean, it is a thing that is happening right now. Like, platforms are figuring out how to deal with political memes mm-hmm. in a way that they did not in 2016, didn't want to, and now they have to.
Right.
So they're figuring that out now. Next to it is this other big policy issue that we've just been tracking forever, which is 230 and what protections the big platforms get for what their users publish on those platforms. It seems like everybody wants to, like, it's the gun. Like, they're mm-hmm. going to point the gun at of taking 230 away from you unless you do what they want. And so one of them is take political ads away. But there's a long list of other ones, right?
I mean, Josh Hawley, the Republicans' major tech hawk, our boy. This list last year, and we don't really hear about it much anymore, weirdly enough, but about conservative bias on social media platforms. It was really hot last year.
Yeah.
And at, like, the height of its hotness, Josh Hawley put out a bill that was like, if you are biased against conservatives, then you lose 230 protections. And we've seen kind of bills jump on this kind of balancing act of 230 versus what I want you to do.
Yeah.
Because 230 is like the greatest, you know what I mean? It's the, one of the most foundational parts of the internet. And it's like, if you just take that away or you threaten to take it away, it's a very major threat when you're trying to get something out of a platform.
If YouTube has to be liable for everything every person on YouTube publishes, like their business goes away.
Yeah, YouTube's deleted.
Yeah. I mean, but so is Instagram, so is Reddit. Mm-hmm. Our comments go. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be responsible for what you put in Verge comments. I'm just telling you. It's just not going to happen. So we would just get rid of it. So it's this foundational thing. We've talked about it so much. But there are a lot of people trying to make a lot of trades against it. So Hawley's one was he was going to have like a committee of like six people who would weigh if you were neutral. Right. Yeah. It was five people. It was like.
But it was they had to come to a consensus. You couldn't have a hung jury.
Yeah,
on
it was
this.
Like a unanimous vote of like Republicans and Democrats that he would just like select
which
out of a hat.
Which would never happen.
It's crazy town. And then they would decide if Twitter was neutral enough to get its 230 protection. Mm-hmm. Fine. There is the Cicilline bill that you're talking about, which seems like it's going to come out, which is you have to have a political ads policy that I like. Or I'm taking your 230 away.
Right. Beto O'Rourke, when he was still running for president, he's from El Paso, Texas. And after the El Paso shooting, he put out a presidential campaign proposal basically saying that there can't be hate speech on platforms. Otherwise, you lose your 230 protections. So we've seen it there. In the most dramatic way, we've heard Joe Biden say, take away 230. Totally. I hate it. Revoke it.
That's a very Biden move.
Right. I mean, does he know what 230 is? Who knows?
I mean, if I could get these candidates to show up, I would ask them very directly.
He knows that he's not supposed to like it 100%. He just wants to get rid of it.
That's Biden.
Yeah.
He's just like emotions. They're doing that because they can't propose these regulations directly, it seems. You can't write a law that demands Facebook have a political advertising policy because you would just run, you're the government, you would just run right into the First Amendment.
Right.
So the dance here is the trade for do what I want or I'll take 230 because they can mess with 230.
Right. I mean, they created 230.
It is a lot harder to carve out the First Amendment.
Right.
So that seems like the underlying 230 action is instead of doing something that might run afoul of the First Amendment, we'll just like hold this gun to your head and say, we'll take away 230 unless you do what I want. That is basically a speech regulation. Is that clear? Like, are people making that trade explicitly, or are they just kind of saying it should happen?
I don't think anyone ever wants to talk about. You don't want to be the lawmaker who's like, "Yeah, I'm thinking about doing something with the First Amendment." Like, that's not a good way to get reelected, you know?
Fair.
So, I don't think a lot of lawmakers have brought that up explicitly. But the idea of like using 230 to wager what you want is definitely. It's in the Senate. It's in the House. It's with Republicans. It's with Democrats. People are thinking about it, and I think if we see any changes to 230. It's going to be with one of these hot button issues, whether it's ads or bias or hate speech, maybe all of them in one. Who knows?
Yeah. And so the one that comes to mind is Bill Barr, who's the attorney general, Lindsey Graham. They've got a bill that they're working on that actually trades 230 protections for encryption.
Right.
Which seems like the other big thing this administration in particular wants is backdoors into encryption for Apple, Google, Facebook, whoever. And the sort of Barr-Graham bill, it feels like Bill Barr wrote it and Lindsey Graham put his name on it. That's just that's my feeling about it.
Cannot confirm, but I mean, no, it's interesting. So the argument over encryption and whether or not we should demand that Apple allow law enforcement to like look into your messages if you're suspected of a crime has happened for so long.
Yeah.
Like so many years. But I think Bill Barr and a lot of the Republicans have noted this 230 discussion and seeing, well, there's a lot of people wanting to regulate tech companies over 230, so maybe this is a way in for us. So, I mean, I would think that the two arguments, encryption has been happening for so long, and 230 is like the perfect out for them to really try to hammer this through into law finally.
So they would say, if you don't give us a backdoor into your encrypted messaging apps, we will take away your 230 protection.
You're going to be sued into oblivion.
Tell the people what the bill is called.
Oh, I love this. The Earn It Act. You got to earn it. I mean, it's basically the summary of all of these bills. It's like, if you want to have what you need, you got to earn it.
Yeah.
From me specifically and what I want.
In
each
my
lawmaker.
Bill about 230.
Right.
But broadly, has encryption come up in the campaign? We've talked about it a lot on the show. It's obviously Apple is very strident about not breaking encryption. Facebook says it's going to reorient all of its messaging apps to be encrypted. There's a lot of back and forth about material that's abusive to minors on the platforms that maybe the cops can't see because it's all encrypted. There's a lot of just general conversation about it,
mm-hmm.
costs and benefits. Is it part of the campaign yet?
Not that I've seen. So there's a lot of issues that are like a big deal that haven't really made it into the broad political campaign discussion right now. And encryption hasn't really been one this year.
Does that seem like it because it's just not a winner to say I support encryption?
Right. I mean, I can't imagine my like 60-year-old mother being like, I'm not voting for Bernie Sanders because of his encryption stance. You know what I mean? It's like not as hot as like healthcare.
Yeah, not fair.
So, I mean, like encryption definitely. I mean, the antitrust plan from Elizabeth Warren came at a really good time, too.
Mm-hmm.
But encryption has been around in the fight to get into people's locked phones by the government has been a fight for a very long time. And it really hasn't had a moment. And I think if we ever had like an encryption moment, the campaigns would be forced to react to it.
And the government, various governments, the Obama administration tried, the Trump administration tried to create those moments with terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be a shooting and then we got to unlock the shooter's phone.
Mm-hmm.
Apple, won't you help us? Apple basically said no. And then, you know, some company shows up and has a way to unlock it mm-hmm. and the debate goes away. I think that's definitely shifted now to child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
That is the basis of the EARN IT Act, actually, is based on abuse towards children. But that hasn't reached the campaign in any meaningful way either.
Not yet, no.
And it's just funny because when I think of politicians, I always think of just like think of the children
right.
messaging. And it seems like it's aligning, but it hasn't quite happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
This leads to, I think, sort of the next one, which is like you've been tracking the progress towards a privacy bill.
Right.
That doesn't seem to have come up in this election at all.
Not really, no. Andrew Yang
had
a big plan. He wanted a data protection agency. He had some stuff, but now our boy's out.
Yeah.
Less tech discussion for all of us on the debate stage, unfortunately. But no, it hasn't really made its way into the big political discussion. The same way that privacy wasn't really talked about in Congress until Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah.
So once again, we're waiting for another moment.
What's the status of the privacy bill in Congress? Because you have been tracking this very closely.
Right. There's a lot of bills. We're waiting for the Senate Commerce bill. For the Senate Commerce Republicans and Democrats to come together and put out one big bill that is the end-all be-all and it's what it's going to be. But they're still fighting over some details about whether or not California can have its own bill, whether or not they should preempt that, or if we should be able to sue.
Individual consumers, you mean?
Yeah, individual consumers should be able to sue when their privacy rights are violated by Facebook or Google or whatever. So they're still kind of hung up on some of these details.
Wait, walk me through that. Shouldn't I be able to sue Google if it like does something bad with my data?
Right. So Democrats agree. They're like, well, most Democrats agree. I hate to say all of them, but most Democrats agree that you should be able to sue if your rights with your data are violated, whatever those rights are in the privacy bill that we get. Because right now we don't really have very many rights.
Right.
Republicans, I mean, this happened with TCPA. So the law that allowed you to sue robocallers and like scammers and stuff, phone scammers. Republicans just don't like the idea of frivolous lawsuits. And they're afraid that if you allow consumers to sue Facebook or Google over these things, it would lead to a firestorm of litigious people with no real claims that would like siphon these big companies with tons of money out of all of their money.
It's like on the one hand, they're like, we'll take 230 away from you and create an existential threat to your business. But on the other hand, we don't want frivolous lawsuits to do that.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. No, it totally makes sense.
We're not going to see a federal privacy bill in the next 2 to 3 years. I was optimistic, and now I am fully pessimistic.
Oh, no.
About this. So it's not going to be in the next 2 to 3 years. It's probably going to be under a different administration. But we are seeing a lot of action from the states. New York is crafting its own privacy bill. California, the CCPA, Washington. There's a lot of momentum from the states to get some rules.
Yeah. But, and that creates like a fragmented marketplace for every company. So it feels like they're going to be annoyed with that enough to lobby their way into a federal bill.
Right. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is already writing op-eds like, we need a federal law.
Yeah. And his law is like, all the stuff I'm doing would be great.
Yep. Don't change anything I'm doing. Don't hurt me.
It just seems crazy that privacy, data privacy, again, right, there's healthcare, there's national security, there's the big topics. But it seems unlikely that none of the candidates would put forward a privacy plan. Because everyone kind of understands it now after Cambridge Analytica. There are lots of Amazon Echoes in the world. It seems like very obvious to say, here's what we think Amazon should be allowed to do with their microphones in your house. And it just hasn't, no one's made that connection yet.
No, not yet.
Right next to that is after Trump got elected and Ajit Pai takes over the FCC and he immediately cancels the FCC's privacy rule for telecoms. So now the telecoms are way less regulated than they were before. There's no net neutrality. The states can't, or they're not supposed to. There's a court fight over that. They can't impose their own net neutrality rules. There's no privacy rules for telecoms. It just seems like the split between how much we care about tech companies and telecom companies is getting ever wider.
Right. I mean, this is really interesting, and I bring this up with a lot of the people that I talk to. But we're not going to see much momentum on federal privacy regulation until we have the same movement that folks like Free Press created with net neutrality. You're not seeing people in the streets or websites shutting down because of privacy.
But there is, it does seem like it's more, I can't quantify it. It does seem like people are more aware of the privacy risks than ever before. It does seem like the split between GDPR and Europe and here is made that more concrete, but that you're saying that hasn't really turned into any action.
No, it hasn't turned into like grassroots momentum or anything like that. And maybe it will in the future. But as of right now, it's not really a measurable effort, you know?
Yeah. The other piece of it, though, is how little we think about telecoms in these conversations. Like we've talked a lot about 230 and speech and what Google can put in its algorithms. We do not talk about what AT&T can do with its network at all, really, and they like own CNN. Does that come up anywhere in this conversation, or is that purely like, where's the internet going to be and who's going to have access to it?
Right. No, I think that's basically it. When you talk about telecoms with candidates, their biggest telecom plans have to do with getting people access because that's still a very big issue. So last month, I went to Iowa and I drove over 800 miles all across the state from Des Moines, like a metro area like Des Moines. I talked to folks who had spotty access, and I went all the way up north, only a couple miles from the Minnesota border, and people who have absolutely no access. So it's those people that a lot of candidates really want to start reaching. So all of the candidates, all of the major ones, have big plans on how to expand rural broadband access, and that's something that Trump promised. And we still haven't gotten. So it's been something that's been in campaigns for a number of years, but something that we haven't seen a lot of momentum on from the executive branch, except from the FCC. They like to create piles of money and allocate that in the USDA, too. But
Why the USDA? And this was in your story, but explain
right,
to people
no,
why the USDA.
So the USDA, there's a handful of grant programs that small providers or even like big telecom providers can get access to lay the fiber, to create the towers, to expand access in rural areas. Because I when I was there, you could travel down a dirt road for a mile, and you could only, if you laid fiber down for that, you would only connect maybe like one home.
Wow.
It is so unprofitable.
Yeah.
So you need that grant money, and it needs to come from a variety of different sources. So the USDA and the FCC has their own grant programs to get that money out. And that can be like millions of dollars, a couple hundred thousand dollars to just get the fiber laid or whatever solution is best for the community.
Right. So the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, is like, we also want you to have fiber because you're farmers?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's basically any small provider who really needs the money they have to fill out. Oh my God, it's such a horrible process.
Yeah.
But and a lot of people hire consultants to like file these grants applications because they're so difficult to file. But yeah, so they just say, hello, we need help. And these are all the reasons why we need help and how many farmers we're going to connect and how many small businesses we're going to connect and how many families and school children. And the USDA looks at that and decides whether or not they'll grant them the money.
Wow.
Yeah. Same thing with the FCC. They've been doing that too. But the USDA Reconnect program has been around since 2018, I think. So definitely not as long.
Yeah. So there's a push to get access. Right now, what do the plans look like? What are the differences between the plans you're
saying? Right. So you have some folks like Amy Klobuchar who are like, $1 trillion infrastructure package. It's going to happen. And we're going to have a lot of money in there for broadband deployment, which makes grants more accessible and things like that. There's also, we are very familiar with this here at The Verge, but there are laws that ban communities from coming together and creating their own networks when AT&T or Verizon or whoever, A, won't lay down the infrastructure needed, or B, it's like too expensive because there's no competition in the area. There are laws in the books in many states that ban communities from doing that. So Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, the more progressive-leaning candidates, want to author some kind of legislation once they're in office that would basically preempt all of those municipal laws.
Yeah. And these are like, they work in cities too. I think Comcast famously lobbied against like Philadelphia's citywide Wi-Fi system mm-hmm. that they wanted to build. Disclosure of Comcast through its NBC Universal arm is an investor of Vox Media. I assure you they do not care for me. it's just a fact. But they've done it in smaller areas too, where you have a bunch of people in a small town. They're like, we're going to build our own Wi-Fi network. Mm-hmm. The town is going to pay for it. And there's like a state law usually that says you are not allowed to do that. Your small town isn't allowed to do that. So the idea here from Warren and Sanders is they would allow small communities to build their own networks.
Right. I mean, to create more competition or just have them have access in the first place.
How is that received? It feels like the municipal broadband conversation just went away for a long time.
Right. So I think when you have more progressive candidates coming in, you hear a lot more about publicly owned utilities. Mm-hmm. So this publicly owned utility conversation is like coming back, I wouldn't say in like full force, but definitely in a recognizable and important way.
How does that square with my favorite, which is the 5G rhetoric, which is we don't need to do any of this. We're just going to put 5G networks somewhere. It's just going to get magically connected.
It's really interesting because nobody knows what 5G is or why it's a race or any of this.
Yes.
So it's really great to rely on that as your supplement for broadband.
But sort of the Trump FCC has, I mean, Ajit Pai, he consistently says he cares about rural broadband. He just put out a white space proposal, another thing that has historically not worked for a decade, but whatever. Now here's a new proposal. He's committed to it in the sense that he talks about it a lot. Has that moved the ball forward at all?
Right. So, I mean, with 5G, I'm not entirely sure. He has the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund that just came out. Some Democratic commissioners have some beef with it, but it is $20 billion that gets into the hands of providers to connect people over the next 10 years, which is very valuable. With 5G, I don't know. I always think back, there was a hearing in Congress a couple weeks ago with Gigi Sohn.
Yeah.
And I always think about that quote because it's like you're relying on a technology that hasn't proven itself yet for such a valuable part of our economy now and something for broadband access that could lift a lot of like people in rural communities out of poverty.
Yeah.
And give them more opportunity. And I just think it's really hard to want to invest billions of dollars into a tech that just hasn't proved itself yet.
Yeah. And especially when AT&T and Verizon and now T-Mobile, the Sprint merger, they're committed to doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could let that play out while you go build the proven network.
Right.
And that just doesn't seem to be the case that's being made.
I mean, it's the divide right now on the digital divide, unfortunately.
So you're saying the progressives want to say community networks. What are the sort of the more moderates on the Democratic side?
I mean, most of it with Klobuchar, it's mostly money.
Yeah.
If you get more money, money is the whole thing keeping people from being connected. So the sums of money are vastly different from like $20 billion. Bernie's plan is like $150 billion. So I don't know how any of this. It also comes back to we've been trying to get an infrastructure package for so long.
Yeah, there's that it's infrastructure week.
Yeah, it's infrastructure week every week and it never actually happens. So it's hard to decide or figure out or even imagine how much of that money would actually make its way through Congress
at any given time? On sort of Republicans and Democrats in Congress? Because, I mean, the more rural states are generally redder, right? They have more Republican representation. Presumably those people would like better networks in their states. Is there any movement on that side of the aisle?
Right. It seems like it's a pretty bipartisan issue. If you look at the committees that handle this for the most part, Republicans and Democrats agree that they need to do something. How they're going to do that, I think, is where they disagree. Like, even when it comes to – this is kind of wonky, and excuse me.
I'm ready for it.
But the broadband maps, right? Mm-hmm. So – right now, telecoms create their own maps. Basically, they send all the data back into the FCC and they craft the maps where people don't have access based on data from the companies. And everyone is basically in agreement, Republicans and Democrats, that these maps are messed up and we need to figure them out like now, like yesterday.
Yeah.
But and there's a couple of pieces of bipartisan legislation that are moving, but Congress is slow. Right now, we're just finished impeachment and all of this stuff. So, I mean, I could definitely see more momentum in the future. But when it comes to a big infrastructure package with all this money, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows.
Well, so this seems like kind of the big theme. We've talked about a lot of different issues. There's an election going on. It's an opportune time for these issues to come to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
And there just seems to be a gap between we're going to take away 230 and scream out Facebook political ads. And hey, huge chunks of America don't have broadband and we don't even know where they are because the maps are bad. Like that is an easy problem for people to understand. It's an easy problem where people agree that the solution is just figure out a way to connect them. We should know where the maps are. And yet that's not being talked to about at all.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that split exists?
Right now in between the campaigns and these issues?
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like what's the most core tech policy issue? It's like literally the digital divide.
Right.
Like at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what Facebook's doing if you can't access Facebook at all.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like that comes up as much as it should. Do you think there's a reason for that? Is it just not politically sexy enough or what is it?
It might not be politically sexy enough, but I'm also thinking that when I was in Iowa and I was covering the caucus, people were shocked to have a tech reporter ask them questions. And maybe it's just because we don't have enough tech people covering this stuff and asking those questions. It's really hard to tell, though. There also isn't a lot of party agreement on how to track these things. Like if the Republicans were running for president right now, for the most part, we'd have the populist wing of the party, the Josh Hawleys versus the libertarian wings of the parties. They can't come to an agreement on what tech policy looks like for them. And I think it's the same thing with the Democrats. You have progressives like Warren and Bernie and AOC who talks for Bernie all the time. And they're like, yeah, break them up. But the more moderate wing of the party doesn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe it's just because when it comes to tech policy, it's such an emerging issue that there just isn't enough agreement in the parties to make it that much of a central issue.
Yeah, there's not even a clear enough split between the parties.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the Josh Hawley proposals – he squint. It look a lot like some of the more progressive proposals. Mm-hmm. Like, I will take control of Facebook myself. I, Josh Hawley, I will do it. Here's what I intend to do. And that doesn't seem like Bill Barr is like, I'm going to buy Nokia.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like your classic small government conservative proposal, but he's like, that's how I'll fix the 5G encryption problem. So I agree with you. Like, there's enough of a spread of ideas that they haven't coalesced into party identities yet.
Right.
But at the same time, it just seems like, well, we're going to cover it. We're going to keep sending you to places.
Mm-hmm.
it seems like it's at the top of mind for how, like, literally how democracy will function, because mm-hmm. what we're fundamentally talking about is how information is distributed, right? And who has access to it and who sees true things and fake things.
Right.
And that I don't think that we're taking that seriously enough, quite honestly.
No, I totally agree. And it's, I mean, it is kind of, it feels, how much did we learn from 2016?
Not enough. I think is the answer, yeah.
No, not enough. The thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently is that in 2016, we came out of it terrified of foreign interference. And now in 2020, the emerging issue is interference from the candidates themselves, with Bloomberg and deepfake videos and things like that. And that's something that gets really closely tied to regulating speech in a way that we're very uncomfortable with, but in a way that is it's a very important conversation that we need to have if these platforms are going to be as important as they have been in democracy going forward.
Yeah. Well, the good news is you're on the podcast today because we're launching a whole thing to do election coverage. You're going to be people are going to see your name a lot. Because you're covering it very closely. What's the next big thing that you think is your focus?
So the things that I'm really interested in are, it may seem pretty minor, but I did a piece on just this random guy out in Washington who's running for Congress as a socialist on TikTok. So I'm very interested in how these emerging platforms are being used and really interested in how candidates, whether it's presidential candidates, congressional candidates, are using the internet to organize, because for a lot of these smaller campaigns, they're quickly becoming national campaigns.
Huh.
Because if you're on TikTok and you're on everybody's For You page, or if you have a Discord server with people who support you all across the country, all of a sudden your small little district in rural Washington or wherever becomes a national campaign.
Yeah.
And that's something I think we're going to see so much more of, and I think it's going to be really important to dig into.
Is that a fundraising thing, or is that just a culture thing?
It's fundraising. It's phone banking. It's text banking. Like, yeah. It's creating big national movements for small little candidates, and I'm very excited to look more into that.
That seems really fun. All right, McKenna, thank you so much for taking the time.
No problem.
We'll have you back on soon.
Definitely. Cool.
All right. My thanks to McKenna Kelly for joining us on this interview episode. Like I said, we launched a big election coverage section of The Verge today. You can go check it out on the site. We're going to be updating those guides to policy issues all year as the election goes on. Obviously, Casey and Zoe are doing the interface, their newsletter about social networks and democracy. There's just a lot of tech policy coverage to come. Check it out on the site. We'll be back on Friday with the chat show. Got to talk about that Mac Pro review. Tuesday with an interview, and on we go. Please tweet at me. I'm Matt Reckless. I love hearing your feedback on the show and who you want me to talk to. We'll see you later.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.